Welcome to NACSW's Podcast of the Month. Our podcast program makes available recordings of a wide variety of NACSW presentations and discussions on topics of particular interest to Christians in social work. Our Podcast of the Month program features a new podcast every 30 days for your listening pleasure. We hope you enjoy today's podcast.
I am happy to be here and so glad to see all of you. Now, I just want to give you a little caveat. I carry my own fur coat, so if I get a little warm, you'll see me fanning from time to time because we don't have the ability to modulate the environment in here. So what I want to do before I get into the actual presentation is just review my presentation agenda. I'm going to be giving an overview of my study, talking about the findings, also presenting and identifying opportunities as well as recommendations, identifying conclusions, and then a recap of this presentation goal, and then an application discussion. I want to invite all of you to work with me towards identifying ways that my suggested recommendations and suggested opportunities may work for you, and I would love that feedback. So towards that end, what I'm going to do is give each of you a set of questions. Thank you. That I'd like you to look at, and I'm just going to give this to you to pass on. That I'd like you to take a look at and keep in mind as I go through this presentation, so that when it comes time for you to actually engage in this area, yes, that some thoughts may have already been generating for you. Now, one note, I just want to make a comment that I will be using extensive quotes in this presentation. This is a qualitative study, and the use of the extensive quotation comes from a couple of different places. One is that I use the womanist theoretical framework in order to design and implement my research. And a womanist epistemology, first of all, womanism comes out of the African-American community. And the epistemology, the way of generating knowledge in a womanist theoretical framework, includes the use of testimony and conversation. That testimony and conversation are valid means of being able to generate information, and that unfolds in the conversation that occurs. So I'm excited about that. And so I'm using the extensive quotations to basically be able to bring the voice of the participants with me into this room, effectively making them co-presenters, even though I will be keeping their names at bay. Okay? So thank you for that. All right, so the goals that I have for this presentation, as previously identified, are that I will build your understanding of four contexts that generate African-American Protestant clergy perspectives about intimate partner violence. Five clinical best practices that are used by the clergy, and the main obstacle to church social work collaboration, and three ways to improve on this. All right, as I go into it, I'd like to share a verse with you from Matthew 11, verse 12. From the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heaven has been subjected to violence, and violent people have been raiding it. My hope is that from what I share today, that we're going to find ourselves more equipped to participate in and at times defend against the onslaught of domestic violence in the church. The pastor's words. It is that one is not called to stay in violence, and we should try to stop the violence while loving both persons and trying to be supportive and seeking help for both persons. So the purpose of this study, again, is to improve an understanding with regards to the perspectives and practices of African-American clergy in regards to partner violence in their church. There were 8 clergy participants, and in a qualitative study, especially when your resources are yourself, they tend to be small. The clergy are from the northeastern region of the United States, 6 men and 2 women. 3 of the 8 are immigrants. to have professional experience in the court systems. In terms of education, 7 of the 8 have masters, and the additional person has a bachelor with added training. And in addition to that, 2 have professional master's degrees in mental health profession. So at least 2 people have 2 masters, and a third person, I believe, has 3 masters. There are 5 different denominations represented: African Methodist Episcopal, Baptist, Full Gospel Church of God, and that is self-identified as being a Pentecostal denomination, Presbyterian, and Seventh-day Adventist. Now, in regards to rigor, when it comes to qualitative study, we look at trustworthiness, credibility, dependability, and authenticity. And that's how rigor is increased, by accounting for as many and even more of the different ways of checking the data, making sure that what you're talking about is accurate, and presenting it in as authentic a form as possible. So I'm just going to give you a brief rundown on exactly what those words mean when it comes to qualitative study. Trustworthiness roughly parallels objectivity in quantitative research. You have objectivity, and trustworthiness roughly parallels that. Credibility is a way of looking at the data over a period of time, so you're prolonging your engagement with that. Dependability is a form of reliability, and that's usually by having a third party review your data and giving you feedback on your process. And then, of course, there is authenticity, being able to present the research data, represent the research data as authentically as possible, as close as possible to what was given to you during those interviews. So ways that I accounted for that in my process was that I did the interviews, I conducted them, and then transcribe them verbatim. After I've transcribed them, I replayed those transcriptions while playing the actual interview to double check my accuracy in taking down all of the information. The transcriptions were reviewed by the participants to ensure that they were accurately represented, and then several participants also gave me feedback on the findings of the research. And that is in addition to having a third party review my process. Okay, now I just want to say a little bit about me and where I'm coming from as a researcher. I am African descended from peoples that in the line back came from Africa. Specifically, I am Jamaican, and I'm an immigrant to this country. And in this country, I've been here now for a number of years, I politically identify as African American. Now, all of these things can influence the way that I gather and interpret data. So I try to account for that in a number of different ways listed here. So I utilize a qualitative descriptive design where I am describing what was presented to me. I use conventional content analysis. I did take field notes of my observations from those interviews, and I utilized open-ended questions. Now, the limitations of this research include the fact that it is a small sample size. There are fewer women than men in the study, and the gender differences were not explored. Also, it's possible that regional differences may exist. I interviewed pastors in the Northeast region of the United States. It's a big country, and there are going to possibly be regional differences. Those I did not get to explore in this research. And it's possible that clinical parallels in the content may differ when clergy are not the ones directly applying the interventions in their churches. So these are some considerations in terms of potential limitations. And in addition to that, you also have the issue of self-selection. Those that agree to participate may have very different views than those who don't. So why religion? Why African Americans, and why clergy? Well, fundamentalists are more likely to go to clergy than anyone else when it comes to addressing their mental health concerns. African Americans seem to prefer faith-based organizations in terms of addressing their issues. And clergy are change agents in their churches. They are change agents with regards to social interactions in the African American community. So it's a perfect place to start. And again, I mentioned I'm Christian. So I'm very interested in what's happening in this community, especially in regards to the intersection of faith with intimate partner violence. And that brings me to this slide. Why am I looking at intimate partner violence? It is defined by the Centers for Prevention of Disease Control, Centers for Disease Prevention and Control, where intimate partner violence is a preventable public health issue. And that makes it perfect for us to look at, to find ways to eradicate it. The risk factors for intimate partner violence. Those risk factors include a history of violence between the parents, a history of victimization by violence in childhood, drug and alcohol use, the presence of alcohol and drug problems, and then there's sociodemographics. And I'm going to go into sociodemographics in a little bit more detail. Sociodemographics can include race, gender, income, and marital status. Now, with gender, more women report being victims of intimate partner violence significantly more frequently than men do. In terms of income, where the income of the woman is higher than the male, there is an increased incidence of domestic violence towards the female. And marital status. While married women have the lowest rate of incidence in regards to non-fatal incidents of domestic violence, they have the highest rates of murder. And this is from the National Crime Victimization Survey that was done in 2004. Now, race. African Americans and Native Americans and Alaskan Native women report the highest rates of intimate partner violence within their communities. These numbers come from the 2000 National Violence Against Women Survey. However, the numbers don't change much 10 years later in the National Intimate Partner and Sexual Violence Survey. So again, what we're finding is that across the board, across the various ethnic groups in this country, women of color have the highest incidence of intimate partner violence. How am I defining intimate partner violence? I'm using a definition from Bent, Goodley, and Fowler in 2006, which is that it is one person's abusive use of power to control another. I also fold into that the details from the CDC, which is that it includes physical, sexual, mental, or emotional violence and or threatening or intimidating behavior. So my findings. These are the themes that emerged from the data that I collected. Those themes include context shaping the perspectives of the clergy, their perspectives in terms of what are factors in intimate partner violence, both secular and theological, pastoral counseling training and their concerns with that training, counseling practices, what I identified as clinical best practices and where it diverges from that, intimate partner violence and the pulpit, how it's discussed by the clergy from the pulpit. The church culture, what's going on there, and then the issue of silence in the church. Seeds of transformation, collaboration with the churches, and then I talk about recommendations, conclusions, and future research. So the context. Wherever we go in the church is the reflection of the leader's philosophic conception. No matter what we do, we can't escape this as the foundational perspective that shapes where the clergy are coming from. We can do all different kinds of outreach, but it's important for us to partner with the clergy to more clearly understand how they're thinking about what's going on in the church. And it is a reflection of their standpoint. Clergy influence. It's the senior pastor who has the strongest influence, who's called the father of the work, that has the strongest influence. The trust that the parishioners have in their pastor is a powerful tool in his or her hand to influence their lives. The pastor has a lot of power. Some of the limitations, despite the fact that they can be so powerful in their churches, include: some people are already trained in the church, but they don't utilize their expertise because of the leader being threatened. The problem is, in some ways, pastors think, if I don't trust this person's faith, or if that person is lying, or this thinking is contrary to mine, so therefore, I'm not going to let that person into my church. These are the perspectives that we encounter as we're entering the churches. And it's important for us to understand not just that we are Christians as we go into the churches, but even in Christianity, there are different denominations, and our philosophical perspectives might differ from that of the pastor. So it's important to understand where that pastor is coming from. The secular roots that they identify include female esteem issues, male ego and male esteem issues, and male ego is male privilege. Male and female aggression. Now, this is an interesting finding, because there is in the literature a type of partner violence that's called common couple violence. And that is where whoever is aggressed against then returns that particular favor. So both partners are violent, and there is no true victim because both are combative in the relationship, and the clergy are saying that they're seeing this. There's also what they're finding is money, drugs, and community violence. All of this is not just coming from the research. It is undergirded and supported in the research, but all of this comes from their observation of what they're seeing in their churches. In terms of spiritual factors, I feel that there is no spiritual integrity. God is not present. The Spirit of God is absent, and there is violence. And I feel that if the Spirit of God is not there, there is emptiness, and the devil has a tendency to fill the emptiness, and the result will be violence. So with that perspective then, how are the pastors looking at and thinking about the way domestic violence is manifesting in the couples? Whenever Christians are involved in a violent relationship, they've compartmentalized their Christianity versus their reality. They will make no reference to Jesus Christ or spirituality at all until you bring it up. And yet, while they define intimate partner violence as I've previously identified, there is an addition, an expansion of that definition. That expansion includes serial adultery. I include serial adultery as part of ongoing domestic violence because of the damage it does to the spouse, the same kind of horrific effect it has on them in terms of the suffered damage, and the fact that they find themselves, interestingly enough, very powerless to get out of that kind of relationship, in the same way that the people who are in the physical violence are powerless to get out of that experience. So they're defining it similarly to what we have already heard, but then this is an expansion, and this is new information. This is not out there, was not out there in the literature until I wrote about this in 2010. Separation and divorce. within at least Massachusetts and the DV community, there is a lot of anecdotal information that clergy don't support separation or divorce. This data contradicts that anecdotal evidence. If there's three or more incidents of abuse, usually the victim is preparing to leave and they come to the minister for justification for separation or divorce. I would advocate either or. Although it's difficult to advocate divorce, it's abuse, in my opinion, is grounds for divorce. I don't think God wants anyone to stay in a relationship where they're being abused, not in a covenant relationship. Training and concerns and their practices. The training that I received is able to help me do what I'm doing. But if I was going up to the level where I was going to be the senior pastor of the work, I'd definitely go further in my training. Introducing me to an appropriate therapeutic counseling mode, teaching me about boundaries, giving me some exposure to some of the various ways that emotional health issues would present themselves, teaching more about knowing how to refer. There was nothing around sexual abuse, molestation, nothing around domestic violence, nothing around intervention, addictions, the recovery process. So that's what was absent that would be critical to have being a pastor. And what these two pieces of commentary represent is the upper portion was for someone who was not in a senior pastor position and truly believes that the training that he had to become a clergy is adequate. No problems, no concerns with that. But if he was going to change into a senior pastor position, that would require a different level. And even at the level that that particular individual held, he was still seeing a lot of issues going on with couples, a lot of mental health concerns. And in light of the fact that we just learned that the senior pastor is the most powerful person in the church, that's the person that most people are going to come to for their concerns around mental health. The more intimate it is, the more they want to talk to the senior pastor. And what I'm finding here is that someone, and this particular individual, is in a senior pastor position, is saying this is just how inadequate the training is around mental health concerns. This presents a potential opportunity for us for social work outreach. How do we then think about what the needs are for the clergy? This is one of those ways. Their practices. I found these and a few others identified in the data. These were some of the practice themes, beginning where the client is, not rushing the recovery process, so giving the person time to cope with the trauma. Prioritizing interventions, which is a form of triage. Case management and advocacy. Reality testing and referrals to community agencies. I'm going to give some representative quotes about these and then talk about it in a little bit more detail. Beginning where the client is, my whole thing is to first hear what people are saying, because they'll tell you what they need. They may not be able to articulate, this is what I need, but they'll tell you. And you'll see what their frustration is. Even if they come in and seem to be on the same page about some things, you just keep listening, and you'll find out people are in different places. Not rushing the recovery process. If you're in a situation where you're being physically threatened, your first step, if you can't figure anything else out, is to remove yourself. So we aren't talking about divorce right now. You got to get out of that situation, and you got to get enough distance and enough time for your sanity to return. Now, what is interesting about this is, while I utilized it here to represent the not rushing of the recovery process, it is also data that supports the advocation of separation. Case management and advocacy. The first occurrence is investigated with great seriousness. I have no problem saying to a victim of domestic violence, "Do you want to go to the police?" Do you want to file a restraining order? Do you want to take out a complaint? And if so, we will assist that person in doing that, even if it is against another member. So despite what we've heard in the DV community around what clergy do and don't do, I'm finding evidence that clergy do advocate separation and do support to the point of even taking it into the court systems. So the practices are what I would consider mimicking or parallel to clinical best practices. They're not clinical practices in that they're not being done by clinicians. And what I found is that the clergy are not trying to become clinicians. They are doing what seems to be most logical. It simply was able to be categorized based on another model that I'm familiar with, the clinical model. Now, one of the things that I found about this is that these practices were not all in the same church. This practice might have been in church A and that practice in church B, and several more practices in this church over here. But they're not all in the same church. And that presents another opportunity for us to do outreach to those churches, to bolster the services that are being offered, to help fill in the gaps so that everywhere someone is able to receive consistent support around domestic violence. There were also divergences from what can be considered clinical practice, and that included conjointly seeing the couple and including prayer. I would myself, you know, come and talk to each one separately and try now to bring them together and say, how can we talk? It's important for them to follow up with me so I can pray with them. Very important for me to pray with them, hear their concerns, maybe give some scripture, some word. They must have the word of God mixed in with what the counselor is giving them. So you're seeing the priority that is held for the clergy. And what we find here is another possibility for our outreach as social workers. Because in the Advent, and almost every pastor I spoke to did advocate for meeting with the couples conjointly, there's an opportunity for us to talk about the potential dangers of having couples meet together, but where they're coming from in terms of implementing this practice is that of wanting the couples, each person, to be heard and each person to be valued. IPV in the pulpit. Now, I asked the question around whether or not intimate partner violence was discussed directly from the pulpit. And what I found was that all clergy agreed that they could discuss it from the pulpit. However, there was disagreement as to whether or not to discuss it directly or indirectly. Two quotes in point. By saying that you're a sinner, it puts a block between you and me. It is better for me as pastor to go with an approach, a soft approach, than tell you exactly what I will do. I think you confuse people, you know, when you beat around the bush. You need to be direct with people. Now, what's important about this particular controversy is the reason that pastors wanted to be indirect about talking about intimate partner violence from the pulpit was what could be called for us therapeutic alliance. They were concerned that if someone that was working with them saw their or heard their issues being discussed from the pulpit, though it might not be their issue specifically, they would stop working with the pastor. So the pastor is concerned about losing the opportunity to work with someone who truly needed the outreach and support. And that parallels for us therapeutic alliance. Now, one of the things that I did was another study, and this study I used actually towards my dissertation. And yes, there are a lot of colors. I'm going to sort this out for you in just a few moments. And I talked to 8 couples, and 8 seems to be my number. But I interviewed them individually and collectively. And what I found in that data was that, now first of all, let me just give you a setup around some of these colors. The 2 brown, number 3 and number 8, were couples where each partner was in a different church. So of the 4 people represented, there are 4 churches represented, and you would expect that they might hear different information. Though in couple 8, both partners were hearing information about domestic violence discussed from the pulpit. In couples 1, 5, and 6, there seems to be some confusion around what is being discussed from the pulpit. Sometimes the men are saying yes, sometimes the wives are saying yes. What is interesting about these 3 couples is that all 3 of them attend the same church. And for me, this is one of the ways that I find support to encourage pastors to speak more specifically about intimate partner violence from the pulpit, because you're not sure what couples are hearing. Now, I also ask them, are they hearing information around how to resolve marital discord? Not specifically violence, but the arguments that they might have. And there was much more consistent information around that. Even around the 3 that are in the same church, couples 1, 5, and 6. What I thought was interesting about this is that the men seem to be saying that, yeah, we're hearing a lot more information about this than the women do. That's another study in the future. So all of this information made me wonder, well, what guides the pastor in saying what he or she says from the pulpit? Is it his or her own volition? Is it just the Holy Spirit? And so I asked someone about that. And this was the response. I think you need to be aware that the Holy Spirit doesn't put you in a tube that you don't connect with worldly issues. Because I think what we get from the Holy Spirit is certainly connected with what's happening in the world. The Holy Spirit isn't like this little tunnel that won't allow you to talk about anything that's social. So there is some volition, and again, a possible opportunity for us to talk to clergy about the ways that they discuss intimate partner violence from the pulpit. However, I want to give a word of caution with regards to this, because if we're coming to pastors wanting to encourage them and influence what kind of information around this topic is presented, we want to be careful that that particular individual doesn't feel like we're telling them what to say, because again, there is a priority of making sure that the Holy Spirit guides what is being said and what is being communicated. So it's a possible opportunity, but I think it's an opportunity that would need a relationship with a particular individual. So church culture, silence, and transformation and collaboration. I think a problem with the church also is that it's sanitized. The church sanitizes its own culture, so certain things do not come up because they're assumed that they would not come up, that they would not occur among Christian people. There is a silence in the church about it. And maybe then there's a theological reason for the silence to overlook intimate partner violence or be quiet about it. And even others, even when others know, they don't say anything. The same way, I think, in the larger society, the idea of not getting involved. You also have that parallel in church sometimes, until things get really bad, and then we say something. Now, what is interesting about this is that this is one quote. However, 3 pastors mentioned that there was no difference between the church and the world. What's interesting about that for us as Christian social workers is that we subscribe to a doctrine that encourages us to believe that there is a difference between what goes on in the church and in the world. Yet here we're finding that the leaders of churches, well-trained, saying that they're not seeing a difference. That also presents an opportunity for us as social workers. What can we do in our process of outreaching that will begin to shift that balance so that more leaders are able to say that they're seeing a difference, so that more people in the pews, because if the leaders aren't seeing a difference, we can believe that the people in the pews aren't seeing much of a difference either. What change is possible? I thought this was very interesting. Several pastors gave information not on what's going on in the pulpit, in the pews, but what's going on in the pulpit. They spoke to the leadership. If we as leaders don't give the congregants the opportunities to feel safe when we share, we silence them. Church has to break the silence. What stops the church from breaking the silence? Our leaders are not well trained to break the silence. If the leader does not break the silence, nobody else will be able to break it. And here too we find another possible opportunity. As we build relationships with the clergy, we get to talk about ways that they have difficulty in breaking the silence. One of the things that I heard was the concern that, okay, if I start now talking about this from the pulpit and I start talking about it directly, I'm going to get a flood of people. So they're going to come to me looking for help. I don't know where I'm going to send them, where I'm going to refer them. I don't have the resources for that. So we're hearing, or I'm hearing, and now I'm sharing with you, so all of us are becoming aware of the fact that clergy are concerned about this, but they don't know what to do with it, and they're not sure what kind of resources they can access to get the support they need to address this adequately. Collaboration concerns. Mental health organizations, in my opinion, reach out all the time to develop these partnerships. They reach out frequently. A church is a world within itself. You don't expect the health agency or the health management facility to have a biblical basis at all. They don't. Oh, sorry, at all. Most of them do not, for the sake of their own funding. They don't. So that's the main stumbling block in developing stronger linkages and better bridges. I think Black pastors and community health centers and hospitals and the larger programmatic structures that provide support to people who are either victims or perpetrators have to sit down. They actually have to start talking. They have to show up in the same room sometimes. And here, there is the recognition that outreach is being done. So pastors aren't assuming that no one is coming out to see them. But there is, again, a reiteration of that distrust as to where the person or the agency is coming from, especially if they are not Christian-centered. And there is, perhaps for Black pastors, a sense that people are overlooking them and doing what needs to be done, but not calling them to the table. Another possibility for our outreach efforts. So let's put all of this together, okay? In revisiting the opportunities for social work outreach, I identified three specifically and a couple of others more indefinitely, because it depends on the situation and the relationship built with clergy. But here are three possible opportunities that I think are clear and specific. We can provide training if desired around mental health issues. We can help the churches bolster their services, fill the gaps, and create more uniform support for those needing intimate partner violence support. And we can attend community meetings that clergy attend, where we can understand the issues that are affecting their conversations, their congregations, and their conversations, and build relationships. So my recommendations are for us to identify and explore conflicts, to determine if our assumptions are valid regarding religious and social work practices. to find common respectful language to build successful collaborations in religious communities, and to remember to apply a strengths-based approach to interactions with clergy that strengthen or create collaborations. Now, these might seem very simple, but again here, I'm presenting recommendations from the perspective of the clergy based on the data that I collected. So clergy are not seeing support and outreach from us in these kinds of ways. Something for us to think about. The conclusions that I have are that this study begins to dispel some of the misconceptions about clergy practice in cases of intimate partner violence. It can be easy for formally trained clinicians to dismiss the experience-based skills that many clergy are able to provide their members. And again, while they are trained as clergy, they are not trained as clinicians. However, their experience compels them to reach out to those in the pews. And the services that they are providing may actually parallel our clinical work. So despite the fact that they're not trained as clinicians, and again, we shouldn't necessarily make that assumption because two of my participants had master's degrees in mental health fields. So they might not be officially trained as clinicians, but the service that they're providing is valid, and we need to look at that, validate where they're coming from, account for the work that's already been done, add on to it. Culturally competent social work research must take place within the cultural context they occur. That means accounting for faith culture as well. And we should design more research that's inclusive of the interests and perspectives of this community, but also report the results back to the community. This is something that I've made a mission for myself when it comes to this research. So I've actually done this in the community as well and reported this back to pastors. And I met with each pastor who was a participant. I turned it into a report and gave that report back to each and every one of them and designed it in such a way, because I recognize they're a busy group, and designed it in such a way that any given page does not require you having read the previous page. So you can utilize it as a reference source book, as opposed to having to read the entire thing. And this way, they're more likely to pick it up, check out a particular topic. And that includes, I collected all of the information that came together around content that might be valid and helpful for them around shaping their own sermons. So they can take a look at this and find sermon content as well. Developing something specifically for churches for African Americans. I thought this was an interesting quote, and this is supported. This is what supports that particular last comment that I had made. This pastor is saying that information is out there, but it's not necessarily specifically developed for churches, and it's not specifically developed for African American churches. And again, what is out there, they're not getting back reported to them. So to use the vernacular that we use in the African American church, we blow in, blow up, and blow out. And that means effectively that we're not depositing permanent resources. And that's our goal. That needs to be our mission in order to create the change that we want to see and that we want to live. Because again, as Christians, we're attending these churches. Yes? So for future research, what I did was I identified three of the upper items come directly from the research, what the clergy themselves are telling me they would love to see in research. Healthy religious families, non-documented victims of intimate partner violence in the church, and pastoral belief or understanding about the impact of intimate partner violence on the congregation. So how is what the pastor thinks affecting those of the pews? The last two were things that stood out to me. I was curious about these. One of the things that I found was that even though some of the clergy had experience in the mental health field or other experience prior to becoming clergy, that didn't seem to shape the structure and the detail with which they talked about this issue. It was their length of tenure as a pastor. And I'd love to research that some more and see how that manifests in the data. As well as looking at the issue as of how to best confront perpetrators of violence in the church. Because again, the clergy are seeing the couples conjointly. So then how do we support the pastors in addressing and speaking to the perpetrators? One of the difficulties of intimate partner violence in the church is the current best way to protect the victim, usually the female, just based on the statistics, is that we put the female someplace else. She leaves her community. She leaves her support. She leaves those that she knows and loves. And sometimes she might do that leaving under a cloud because, again, the perpetrator stays. And the perpetrator may have been manipulative. That includes in the information that he shares or she shares with his or her friends as that person stays. So we really need to take a look at what we're doing in regards to the ways that we're helping pastors address this issue in the church with perpetrators. So I want to recap my goals. I had said that I would identify for you four perspectives that, the context that shape the perspectives the clergy has. And that includes experience with members and observation of issues within their churches, a recognition that spiritual issues contribute to intimate partner violence, violence among Christian couples being facilitated by the way that they compartmentalize their faith, and recognizing that marriage is a covenant that is broken by intimate partner violence. These are the contexts that shape the perspectives. The practices. These are five of the practices that I discussed today, beginning where the client is, not rushing the recovery process, case management, advocacy, and referrals to community providers. Now again, you may not find all of these in any one church, and what we can do is to begin bolstering that process. And collaborations. Developing good collaborations includes remembering to respect the experience-based skills that many clergy are able to provide their members. Assess the assumptions we make and that we bring to meetings with clergy. And acknowledge and address any conflicts in our philosophical approaches. Now, this particular one I want to say a little bit more about. Conflict. If you've got two people in a room, you may have conflict. There is nothing wrong with the fact that there may be differences in your approach from the way that person in the church is approaching this issue. It's not about having the difference. It's about not talking about it and understanding and shining a light on how those differences are manifesting. That's very important. Because that's where we begin to build the bridges. That is why it is so important for us to communicate, to reach out, and to be clear about the fact that we are coming from different places. So let's see how we can work together. What are our commonalities? And where do we diverge? Very important. And create ongoing partnerships with churches beyond the focus of just crises or agency projects. The pastors were saying to me that, yeah, people come in. Often they come in around a crisis, and then when the crisis is addressed, they're gone. So we're no better off in the end than where we were in the beginning. Or they come in for an agency project. Great, we get the support, but is it the support that we're looking for? So build those relationships in ongoing ways so that it's not just about blowing in, blowing up, and blowing out. And that will allow us to develop more effective collaborations and partnerships. The pastor's words. One thing I would like to mention is we must see things differently. In the past, there were problems that were not addressed from the pulpit because nobody knew those problems existed. But now we know the problems exist. and we know what are the consequences. Church should do a revolution. So here is where I then begin to draw your attention back to the sheets that I gave you at the very beginning. I had made some recommendations around what social workers need to do. What I would like from you is your feedback and your thinking about the ways that this actually is valuable to you, or information that I might use in terms of revising my recommendations so that they're more effective. So to that end, I want to start with the first question. What might get in your way as a social worker if you attempted to implement these recommendations? And I'm going to bring those back up. I'll give you a few moments to think about that. And since we've got a good crowd, you can just speak up as you're right. You don't have to raise your hand.
As I reflect on your questions and listening to what you shared, I really appreciate it. Dr. Berkeley Michelson also says marriage is adulterated through violence, and therefore many times divorce has to be the next step. For me, a piece that would be difficult is working with folks who have the attitude that anything goes once a covenant is made, and trying to find safety, and you can't have continuing a relationship that's violent, it's no longer healthy, to working with those folks that the clergy who do not see it as it's terminated.
Okay. So then would that mean for us in terms of our work as social workers? Is there an opportunity there for us to meet with the clergy, or is there perhaps a different issue that we might not be able to easily touch? Any thoughts on that?
I guess the latter. You would want to meet with the clergy, but if they have an understanding that's deeply ingrained that it's only adultery or that is the basis, biblical basis for divorce, then I think you've got a deeper issue.
Okay. All right. And with regards to that, then one of the things I think we would need to do in terms of our effort as we go back, because even when you're hearing information like this from the pastor, you don't want to break that relationship. They're still in conversation with you. And even if it's a difficult conversation, both of you are still there. And I would say to maybe then begin engaging that particular clergy person around the passages that deal with violence in relationships, and to see how that influences the individual, and maybe even call in other trusted clergy to then open up the conversation so that it doesn't become polarized. So I really appreciate that. Thank you. Other thoughts on that question?
I think one of the things, you know, thinking about several of the pastors that I know, is that the reality is that many of these pastors are in conflicting situations based on their own position, and the fact is that they are voted on. Their job is there. And things are tenuous out there right now. And the reality of how much of this stuff is actually going on is pretty significant. And its impact and the ripple effect of, okay, well, it's not just the husband and wife. Now it's usually impacted the children, and there's usually other things that are involved. And it just becomes this, you know, do you even start pulling the piece of yarn to try to undo this thing? And I don't think that there is that many that feel that strongly in their particular position that they want to go real far with that thing, to actually get down to roots. And so, quite honestly, I think that for the most part, and I don't mean this in a negative fashion at all, but the reality is that most would attempt to go with a Band-Aid approach and try to get out of it as quickly as they can.
And that's realistic. And first I'm going to acknowledge what you said is not only valid, I heard it from the pastors.
Okay.
So there is seeing just how deep this issue can really become, that the root and the potential offshoots and tributaries for this particular issue can be way more than the available resources at the time we begin the conversation. However, if we are approaching this systematically and recognize that this is just a beginning conversation, where we're then identifying what the needs are and beginning to tease it out, and we're not looking at this as a way of mass producing outreach efforts for any given agency or individual social worker or social work group, but rather we're going to really take a look at what it takes to address this issue thoroughly in this one church.
Mm-hmm.
Build a solid relationship that includes unpacking as much as possible all of the different concerns that that clergy may have, and bringing in supporting individuals that that clergy person identifies to say, oh, wait a minute, you know what, you forgot this. And what about? And suppose. Because without identifying the areas where there are concerns about deficits in services and resources, you don't know where to begin to bolster, where the gaps are, what needs to be identified, what can be brought in, possibly even grants written. But you've got to start by identifying, and identifying as thoroughly as possible, and recognizing that this is a progressive revelation. It's not going to all be identified at once. So you have a conversation, you begin working on this issue, and you realize that there is an attached issue that also needs to be addressed. And then we begin to figure out what resources can best be brought to bear to address this associated issue as well. And you take a look at agencies that are available and willing to connect with the work, with this church, that might be able to address those particular issues. Because ultimately, one of the benefits for community agencies is they are going to be getting more people coming in to utilize their services, and every agency survives in that way. However, not just doing it randomly, but to do it with structure, to do it in a systematic way based on conversations, and to really take a look at the partnership that is being developed and how we end up creating wraparound services for the church. In the same way, we currently have the resources to create wraparound services for individuals and families. And those individuals and families are in those churches. So that might be a way to begin addressing that. That you start with one conversation. You recognize that it's not going to be the only conversation. You begin to identify the resources and the depth of need. And you systematically begin addressing those, recognizing that this is going to be a long-term relationship. So thank you. Good information.
I think one of the most difficult things is that, you know, when you have a pastor who's working under the guidance of the Holy Spirit to actually help people to heal, which is really the only way it can happen,
mm-hmm.
the reality of how many layers down it goes is just so extensive.
Yes.
That the reality is we don't have the time.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
they don't have the energy, you know, to deal on that level because it's intense. Then on top of that, if you put that in a church membership, so
mm-hmm.
to speak,
mm-hmm.
and you start rocking family dynamics because it's going to,
mm-hmm.
you know, then all of a sudden, you know, everybody gets a little bit nervous. And, I see it as a really difficult place.
Mm-hmm.
And you can call in Christian counselors, but if they have to bill and they have to do all of that, they're going to do the secular thing.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
It really doesn't function quite the same way
mm-hmm.
as leadership, you know. And again, I mean, that's in my practice. I don't take insurance for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can't function with that same leeway, so to speak, with the guidance of the Spirit to really make it a ministry mm-hmm. and start doing that generational work that needs to see. Because when you come in with a couple and you see them mm-hmm. and you have violence, well, you can be darn sure that this has been a generational pattern. Mm-hmm. And usually then you get into the sexual abuse and then you get into, I mean, this thing goes crazy on you.
And this is true. But one of the things that I am asking is for us to really find ways to think out of the box in addressing this issue. Another thing that I can point out for you, because what you were talking about are issues that amount to various aspects of faith culture, in this case, Christian faith culture.
Mm-hmm.
And that means you're trying to work with your couples in a culturally congruent way. And for that, you can find support in the insurance industry. Because cultural competence is a main concern in terms of being able to work with the people in the community. So you are presenting to the insurance agency the ways in which you are addressing the culturally competent, a culturally competent approach with this couple that you're working with, or with any other individual that is coming to you who is faith-based. And again, that is the key.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can't do it outside of the cultural context of the fact that they are Christian. And if we want, ultimately, for there to be a difference between what's going on in the church and what's going on in the world, then we've got to bring their belief system to bear. What do they find supportive? How is it supportive? And then, how can we leverage that in ways that the person is able to maintain that connection with their faith in a solid way? And heal, and change, and transform. And that can only happen with culturally competent social practice that accounts for the fact that Christianity and any faith is a culture that someone is subscribing to. Thank you. So I'm not saying it's not that deep and not that complex, but I'm saying that we've got to maintain our hope as we enter this work. Recognize that it is long-term. We cannot ask the clergy to take this on solely. Clergy, especially in the African-American community, are like CEOs of huge corporations. And as such, they cannot be expected to do everything. Any CEO has their supporting staff that are in charge of this, overseeing this, taking care of that. And as such, there is delegation that is to be expected. Work on that, utilize that, and find out what are the ways that partnership can occur. And yes, there may be multiple issues, but again, we're talking wraparound services, a wraparound approach, as opposed to a head-on linear approach, because it's too complicated for us to begin to apply our resources in a linear fashion. We just can't, just like branches of a tree and tendrils and roots. It just goes out in ways that a linear process can't address. But very good information. I appreciate the fact that you are continuing to work on how complicated this really is. Because if we don't look at the complexity, we can't begin to find a more appropriate way to address it. So that is not an unwelcome comment. It is a needed comment. And I thank you for it. Okay, now I know our time is short, so rather than asking the second question in this area, I'm going to go to the single question in the last area. And that is around the opportunities for outreach. Because notice, those opportunities include that we can provide training around mental health issues, bolster services, and attend community meetings. However, one of the things that we keep coming back to, because we haven't broken the model yet, is that we keep coming from our perspectives. So how do we believe that we can take advantage of these or other identified outreach opportunities while keeping our efforts collaborative and client-focused when it comes to working with clergy in the churches? And that may not have a single answer, but it is a question that I would like us to continue thinking about.
Now, if anyone would like to try to respond to this, I'm definitely going to give you some time. But if not, this can also be a good place for us to end, because sometimes it's not a neat ending. It's an ending that causes us to continue ruminating on the issues, because the answers come later. And sometimes the resources might not yet exist for the answers that we need. Any thoughts or last questions? Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today for NACSW's Podcast of the Month featured selection. We hope you found today's session useful and that it will support your efforts to thoughtfully integrate Christian faith and social work practice. We also hope that you will consider participating in additional NACSW's activities and events, including NACSW's upcoming convention in the fall, our quarterly audio conference workshops that we offer at no cost to NACSW members, and which includes free CEUs accredited by the Association of Social Work Boards, our online continuing education program, and access to dozens of archived podcasts from the members section of our website. Also, we invite you to join NACSW's Facebook group or our Facebook fan page. For additional information about these and other NACSW benefits and services, you can go to our website at www.nacsw.org. Thanks again for listening in today to our podcast session today.